welcome to Future Library. Another week has passed in this wonderful world of podcasting. And I have a guest, as always, and I'm starting to become aware that I'm saying that every episode at the moment. I'm always saying I have a guest, as always. Maybe I'm just going to start introducing the guest. Maybe I'll just start by saying in future episodes, I'll say, welcome to Future Library, I'm your host Alex Botton, and this week's guest is blah, blah, blah. Maybe I'll do that, but this week isn't that week. But I have got a guest, as usual. And again, I've talked myself down a dead end already within minutes of the show starting. My guest today, I first encountered him, I think, on MySpace, but I'll discuss that with him in a moment. He was in Liger. He was in a load of side projects at the time, then in Swan Fangs, now performs solo, and has got lots of things coming up. It's Dino Spilatini. Hello, Dino.
Hi.
Yes, I apologise for my...
That was a nice introduction.
It was slightly rambling, wasn't it? But that's what it is.
I like your voice, so it sounded good.
Well, that's very nice to hear. I'm glad to hear you like my voice.
Hello. Yeah.
That's what I put on my sexy radio voice, and I get close to the mic. And I go, ladies and gentlemen, please be careful driving home tonight. It is icy. Up next, photographs of you by Flock of Seagulls. So, Dino, obviously, and again, I say this every episode, and I'm starting to become aware that certain things are becoming almost cliche. So I'm going to have to maybe mix it up from next week onwards. But obviously, I've known you for a while, but there's some listeners who don't know anything about you. So Give me a bit of background for the sake of our listeners.
My name is Dino Spilatini. I live in Vienna, Austria, where I work as a freelance graphic designer and musician. And I currently release music under my own name and also as Swan Fangs and a very new project called Islands of Light. I was in Liger and a couple of other side projects, and I used to run Beatles Murder Records, and before that, Beatles Murder Net Label, and yeah, that's about it, I guess.
Yeah, and going back to what I said a moment ago, how did we first meet? I can't quite remember.
MySpace, obviously.
I think it was MySpace, yeah.
Yeah,
I think, I can't remember what led me to, either you ended up on my page.
I just thought about that before you called me, and I think that it must have been like almost 10 years ago.
Jeez. Yeah, it would
be, wouldn't it? Is that possible? Yeah.
I think it is. I think that's right, because it would have been about 2004, 2005 kind of time.
Yeah.
Because I vaguely remember, was there some talk of us doing some shows in Europe at one point and vaguely trying to organize it?
I think so, yeah.
With David Roy from, who ended up in Dan and Aykroyd and
Text Adventure.
I think that might have been it. I think it was. I think that's how I got introduced to you. I think it was vaguely at that point when we were talking about people in different places, and maybe that's how it happened. Yeah, so that would be 10 years ago. Jesus. At the time you were obviously doing Liger. I was doing The Moths. For the sake of listeners who maybe don't know, Dino actually did release a couple of The Moths things on Beatty's Murder on the Net Label, which was very nice of him. I always liked that you did that. you were a supporter, so that was a good thing. I did one of my few.
The music was great, also. It wasn't just for the sake of supporting you.
it was the music was all right, but thank you. So you were in Liger for all this time, and you moved from Austria to Berlin for a bit. So what was behind the move?
Well, you know, Vienna is kind of small, and at one point I thought that I have to move on and I have to do bigger things, you know. And so the next logical step is to go to Berlin. And it was like I had this idea and then I did it. I didn't really think about it. And then I ended up in Berlin, and then I thought, well, this is too big for me. And then I went to Hamburg, and this was still too big. And then I ended up like living on in a farmhouse for 3 years. So I kind of moved from Vienna, which I thought was too small for me, to an even smaller place in the end. And yeah.
And now you're back in Vienna.
Now I'm back, yeah.
Yeah. And do you find now you've come back to Vienna that you're kind of going, actually, this was all right?
I'm not sure yet. Yeah, this remains to be seen. I don't know.
You see, maybe. I have a theory about smaller places. I don't know what the population of Vienna is. How many people live there, roughly?
About 2 million.
Oh, so it's still quite big then.
Yeah.
Okay. So, I mean, I kind of have an opinion about, you know, places that are relatively small or a bit kind of off the beaten track in terms of musical things, that they tend to be more interesting in what they output because they're not being looked at by the press so much. What exists of the press anyway these days. And maybe people, because they're aware that they're not going to be looked at by the press so much, don't really worry about becoming famous, so they just do their own thing. So is that true of Vienna, or is that completely wrong?
I'm not sure. Yeah, it's not completely wrong, maybe, but it's, you know, everyone in Vienna wants to be, I don't know, like in the, let's talk about, I don't know about the experimental music scene, but I know about the indie scene, and everyone wants to go to Berlin and be famous and shit like that. That was my problem. Everyone ends up staying in Vienna and being too comfortable with being like kind of famous in Vienna.
Yeah.
But still, they're still thriving to be famous. But it's, I don't know. It's not like they're. Yeah, I don't know. For me, it was like it was a narcissistic motivation to go to Berlin and I don't know.
Do you feel more comfortable being kind of well known in Vienna rather than trying to be famous globally?
I was uncomfortable with only being famous in Vienna. I wasn't really famous in Vienna, you know, but I thought that I was as famous as I could be.
Yeah, I see, yes.
Yeah. So now I'm back and I'm unfamous now because, you know, I'm not playing in bands anymore and hardly anyone knows me anymore, but
I think I can relate a little bit because, I mean, when I moved away from Dundee, I was kind of at that point because Dundee only has 120,000 people. I think it's actually gone up a little bit, so I think it's more about 130 now. So it's fairly small, but it had reached the point where I pretty much knew all the musicians in the city. And if I decided to go and walk in the city centre to go and have a look at the shops, it was almost guaranteed somebody would say hello to me. And it had reached the point where it would be people I didn't know would say hello to me. I go, all right, Alex, how you doing? And I'd be like, hi. And, you know, my girlfriend at the time was like, who was that? And I was like, I have no idea.
Yeah.
And it had got to that point, and I kind of felt at the time that was maybe bad. And I kind of thought, I feel a bit smothered here. It's, you know, there's not much opportunity. But the thing was, I was playing gigs all the time there, like on a weekly basis, and people would come along, and I could get into other shows. I never really paid into shows at all anymore. And you know, I had venues that I could put gigs on at really easily, but I kind of didn't appreciate it at the time. So I then moved away.
Yeah, I can relate to that, yeah.
Yeah, moved away, ended up down south near Brighton, which I hated Brighton, then ended up back in Birmingham unexpectedly with my parents, and Birmingham's really big and kind of soulless as well. So I think there's the idea that, you know, oh, well, you know, I'm doing all right here. How much better could I do somewhere else? You go off and do it, and then it's not good. And then you come back
and you've
lost your chance there. And then in Dundee, again, if I go back now, I'm, like you say, unfamous. So, you know, I can walk down the street in Dundee anonymously. People don't know who I am at all. Even friends won't recognise me now if I walk down the street. You know, I think it's a case of that if anybody's listening who's thinking about going, oh, well, my little local art scene, which is quite supportive but quite small, isn't big enough for me, I'm going to go to London or I'm going to go to Berlin or I'm going to go to Paris or whatever, don't.
New York.
Don't. Stay where you are because it's better. And with the internet, it's still better because you can do the things, you know, you can get shows sorted out quite easily by booking them online. You don't have to live in the place where it's all going on, really. I find big places overwhelming, and I think that's my main problem. I kind of like where I'm living now because I'm living in a small kind of satellite town between Birmingham and Wolverhampton. just a couple of miles down the road from Wolverhampton and a few miles from Birmingham, but it still feels like a smaller place. So I haven't really kind of delved into any of the art scene around here at all, but there's a sense there's a little bit more kind of, you know, maybe it'll be a bit easier to deal with. But so, yeah, so you've come back from Berlin. I know that one thing I was talking about with my wife earlier was, didn't Berlin, the German government changed the way they were taxing artists anyway? So it was making it suddenly more expensive.
I don't think so.
Okay. I think it was just something that I remember Joe Howe from Ben Butler and Mousepad mentioning that a while ago, because he lived in Berlin for a bit as well. And he left.
I don't know. I'm still registered as an artist in Germany. I don't think that anything has changed. At least it didn't for me, no.
Okay.
I hope so. Yeah,
it may have been that they were talking about doing it and it never happened or something, but I know that a lot of people that I knew that were living in Berlin at the time were saying, oh, it's going to be too expensive to live here because of this and I'm going to leave. I know that Joe left and Momus left and, you know, various people.
I think it's still one of the cheapest places to live. I think so.
You see, I really like Germany. My only experience of Germany has been Frankfurt, which I've been to a couple of times, and I really like Frankfurt. There's something about it that's just nice. I don't know if there's any kind of artistic scene there at all, but there's, I don't know.
maybe it's good if there isn't. I don't know. Maybe there's so many bad scenes. Lack of a scene could be a good thing. I don't know.
Well, I think it's the problem you get sometimes is, like you said, all the kind of indie bands who are all wanting to be famous. And really, there's not much likelihood of that happening now. Indie bands, if you're listening. The world has changed. It's not 10 years ago. It's not 20 years ago. You know, the most sensible piece of advice I could give to bands listening was get a decent day job that will allow you to have time to do your music.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I did, like, only 2 months ago. It's when I started following this path. And it's really a great idea. You know, it pays off for me.
Yeah, because this
I work 20 hours now. It's not too much. It doesn't smother me in any way. Supports my music.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's how it should be. And I've done a similar thing with the way I work. I mean, I compressed my week hours so that I now work Mondays and Tuesdays and then Thursdays and Fridays. And I have Wednesday off. So I have that gap in the middle of the week, which is a nice break. Makes me feel less stressed. And gives me a little bit of time on my own during a day to do things, you know, so it's good. Mm. So, yeah, maybe, you know, and it was quite interesting. There was an article recently about Grizzly Bear and about how they're making virtually no money. And they had like a top 10 Billboard charts hit at the time. And were making less, when you looked at it, than somebody on a basic wage working in a call centre would make. So, I think the idea of being rich and famous for music is maybe a thing of the past, or something for a very small number of people.
Certainly, it's the wrong motivation anyway. Mm-hmm. For becoming a musician, isn't it?
Definitely, and it's not for the likes of us. Let's be honest. So you've moved back to Vienna now. I've been listening to some of your music this afternoon to kind of just get myself into the right kind of headspace for doing the interview. And interview, what a formal sounding word for such a ramshackle thing that I do. And over the years, there's been a noticeable change in the way your music sounds. Because with Liger, there was almost. It was kind of quite upbeat in some ways and quite kind of poppy and had that slight edge of almost hysteria that people like Shushu do and things like that. And it had that kind of slightly kind of frantic kind of, you know, pushing forward thing. And then Swan Fang seemed to be a lot darker.
Yeah.
And then your new things, the three albums that you've got going at the moment, which are the All I Want to Be... All I Want Is to Be a Happy Man, which I don't know when that's coming out, but you let me have a listen to that one. And there's the Modular Anxiety release and the piano release. Rübke. I don't know how to pronounce that. Rübke?
It's Rübke, actually, but it's the place where I lived in the farmhouse.
Fantastic. So those three records And it seems to go from the kind of almost pop stuff of Liger through the slowly darkening stuff of Swan Fangs and then into these three records where the... Well, how can I describe it for the listeners? In the... In Liger, the vocals were still quite kind of forward and everything, and it was still this kind of quite kind of up, kind of joyous kind of thing. And then in Swan Fangs, it seems that the vocals have become more kind of dark sounding and are more sparse. And then the vocals have vanished altogether on the new releases. Has there been a changing mood there, Dino, do you think, over the years?
I think it's also known as aging. I don't know. It's like, you know, Liger was like young people's music, you know. Like,
And you get to the, because I mean, your latest things are, I mean, certainly two of them are quite kind of, but actually, in fact, all three of them are kind of verging on almost drifting into ambience. But certainly a very synth heavy and very, you know, there's nice piano stuff on Rubka, and there's definitely a lot of synth on the other two. Do you think that has been a reaction to aging then?
Yeah, of course, definitely. It's I don't know, kind of it's mirroring my personality and how I live now. I don't, you know, I'm not going out anymore. I'm just, you know, staying at home and I don't know, like, you know, being depressed and shit like that. And it's not like, it's not about dancing and not about, I don't know. Yeah.
No, I think
it's more laid back and things like that.
No, I think I can understand that. I mean, I kind of find that, because I don't know if I've mentioned it. Maybe I have mentioned it on the show before. If I haven't, I should have done. It's not a secret that I keep from anybody, it's that I suffer from anxiety and depression and have done for as long as I can remember, and take numerous bits of medication for it and things like that. And I find that very much reflects in the way I then work musically. And I think you can chart my mental state over the last 10 years over the various records I've made. So I've, you know, made things that were very fractured sounding, and things that were then these kind of like little concise pop records, and then things would get all fractured again, and then it would get more confused, and you know, now I'm having to make a conscious decision to try and make music that sounds upbeat, whereas I just want to make long drone things with a synth, you know. So do you think there's, I think it's something that it does, it's hard not to have it reflect how you're feeling, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, I think like with Liger, then it was a conscious decision to, you know, I want to make something sad, and I want to make something. Blah, blah, blah. And now it's like it's real, you know. It's not a decision anymore. It's like I make music, and it turns out to be like, you know, dark and, you know, not upbeat. And yeah, I'm not. I can't take this decision anymore. It's just what I am and what I do.
Yeah. Well, I think, I mean, the way I see it, the way I make music is that, and it's something I've talked about on the podcast before, so I won't kind of go into it at any great length, but it's, I just start, and whatever comes out, the other end comes out. I don't go into it with any great plan. I maybe have a vague idea of a shape a record's going to have.
Yeah.
But I don't have, the thing is, when I'm kind of thinking about how, before I start making a new record, I find myself kind of thinking about it visually rather than musically. I kind of visualize colors and shapes and things, and that then informs the way I want that record to sound. Does that make any sense at all?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. You know, it's the same for me. I don't have any concepts. I hate having concepts for your art. That's why I quit like studying art, because everyone had these concepts always, and these, you know, intellectual backgrounds for their art, and that's not the way that I work. You know, I just start and see what happens.
Yeah, and that's
I think
that's a really important way to work. I think you could sit down, and you sit down with a blank canvas or an empty screen, or, you know, your digital audio workstation of choice, and you sit down, you open it up on your computer, and you just look at it, and then you hit record and you play something, and then you then play something else, and then you play something else, and you stick those bits together, and then you move them around
a bit.
Yeah,
that's what they call flow. That's the best that could happen when you work. Of course, it doesn't always happen, and it's like, that's how it should work.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I always was kind of very influenced by was reading an interview with Lou Barlow from Sebado years and years ago, and him saying that the first idea is often the best idea, and you should record it the first time.
Yeah.
You do it first take, and then you just don't go back to it. You finish it and move on. And that's kind of stuck with me as well. And I don't know if that's something... I mean, do you go back over your work, or do you just...
Constantly, yeah. That's something I have to deal with, and something that I have to, you know, I'm always second guessing everything. And I try to stick to this idea with first take is the best take, and first idea is the best idea. But unfortunately, that's not how it works for me. But I'm trying.
So, do you find it, when you say you second guess things, do you find that you go back and listen to it, and you try to listen to it as other people would hear it, or how does that work for you? Or
sometimes, yeah. But I don't know. I listen to it, and when I listen back to it, it's like, you know, I'm very, I don't know. It's always, when I make something, it's always shit when I listen to it. I don't know how else to say it.
Well, maybe I can say it in a way that you'll relate. I listen to my music, and I compare it to the music of my peers, and I go, mine's crap compared to everybody else's.
Exactly, the comparing.
Yeah,
what happens. That's what needs to stop.
Yeah, and it's then combined with that whole thing of, and I think you, I don't know, tell me if you relate to this, of the feeling of they're going to rumble me any second. They're going to work out that I don't know what I'm doing.
No, I'm not sure about that.
You know, at least you've not got that part. Because I'm always convinced that somebody's going to turn around one day and go, wait a minute, this is shit. And I'm going to go, no, you've worked it out. I don't know what I'm doing. I've never known what I'm doing.
It's really weird. No, sometimes I'm really very confident about my music, and the next moment it's like the opposite. So, of course, I'm always comparing it to other people's music, and I shouldn't do that, but
it's hard not to.
I don't know how to stop. Yeah, of course.
There's that whole thing, and Morrissey got it absolutely right with that song, We Hate It When Our Friends Become Successful, because there's that whole feeling of, you know, you see somebody else has done something well, and you go, bastards, why isn't that me? You know, and the thing is, the reason often, in my case, the reason it's not me is because I haven't made any effort to get any gigs and haven't recorded anything.
And I'm
sitting there going, but it should be me, even though I've done nothing to deserve it.
I got it all in my head. I got the whole, the album is finished in my head.
Yeah. I'm famous in here. Come on, you bastards! And it often does come back to not having actually done anything.
Exactly. So,
and then I feel bitter because, and also I'm rubbish at networking. I don't know if you're any good at that.
Yeah, I hear you. I'm worse at networking than I was ever before. I was really bad like 5 years ago, but I'm now even worse. You know.
Have you gone from bad to terrible?
Exactly, because I'm not going out anymore, and I'm not meeting people, and I can't. I'm very bad at sucking up to people from the internet, and you know, it's really hard.
Yeah, so I hate kind of I hate talking to venues. I hate talking to promoters.
I stopped doing that. I want other people to do this for me.
Yes.
It's great that I'm releasing on labels now, and they are like, you know, they are sending out the promos, and I don't have to do anything. The reviews come in without me doing anything.
Yes, that's nice, isn't it? When
it's great. Yeah, it's a great relief.
Yes, you know, I'm going to chase people up. Because I know that I hate asking people for things. I hate...
I hate selling myself,
That's the other thing. I mean, I have the feeling that I'm some kind of fraud. So selling myself to other people is very, very difficult. Because, so this has been very positive so far, listeners. You know, you're thinking inside the mind of doubt of what actually happens with musicians. So you've got these three records. So, well, how did the, let's have a look at Modular Anxiety first, because that's obviously the split record. So how did that come about?
I don't know. Like 1.5 years ago, I was going insane with trying to write songs and make, you know, kind of pop music, and I decided to take a full stop and to do something else just for fun. And I really made these couple of tracks in, you know, just a week or something. And I didn't know if they were any good, and I sent them to my friend Niels, who is on the B side of the record, and he liked them, and we decided to, you know, send like our tracks to a couple of labels, and you know, the second label we sent it to, Humorex, they decided to release it, and it was, I don't know, it was a big surprise, and apparently people like the music, so that's good.
And the thing about it, I mean, it's really nicely packaged. There was the gold vinyl edition.
Yeah.
It just looks beautiful.
I don't know. Do you know of any other golden vinyl records? Because it's obvious to do it, but I don't know any other records that came on golden vinyl.
I don't know that I've got any that are on gold vinyl. I've got lots of white vinyl and lots of red vinyl and blue vinyl,
green, whatever. But gold, I don't know. It's although it's so obvious,
and it's a preemptively gold record. Hey,
yeah.
you can legitimately say to people, yeah, well, I've got a gold record, and they go, oh, you sold so many copies. No, it's actually gold.
Yeah, no, I thought about framing it, but
yeah, well, you should.
I think my name is not on the label of the record, so that would be perfect.
Well, what you
if
do?
It had my name on it, but you know, if I would frame it, I would have to. I don't know. You know, the label is without any names. Yeah. The label on the record. So I don't know. Whatever. It's not perfect. It would be perfect if it would say Dino Spilatini on the record itself.
Well, what you should do is you should get a long, thin frame and put the cover, the insert, and the record all together.
Ah,
and that would look good.
Oh, I might do that. Yeah.
I'm speaking as a person that's been heavily involved with the decorating of my new house, so, and I can tell you, that would look good on a wall.
You moved into your house almost the same time that we moved into our new flat, I think. When did you move into your new house?
Oh, September, I think.
Yeah.
And we actually bought a place, which is, you know, a first for us.
Yeah.
I'd rented forever, and we went from a one-bedroom flat to this three-story.
Yeah, you seem to be very happy.
It's nice. It is very nice. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I have to say. And when next time you're in the UK, you are more than welcome to come and stay here, because we do have a spare bedroom.
Oh, great.
It's a spare double bedroom, lots of space. We've got an office up here, which I'm sitting in at the moment. And it's all very nice. It works. It works for us. So you moved back to Austria around the same time as, you know, we moved into our house, which is it's very exciting. I hate moving house, though.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I hate it. I don't want to do it again for a very long time.
Okay. I hate moving out of a place, but I love moving into a new place. No?
Is it the packing up that you don't like?
Yeah, mostly, and nostalgia, and I don't know.
Do you do the whole thing where you have to be the last out, and you look around as if you're in a sitcom? you nod to yourself, do a little sigh, and then you switch off the light.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, man.
It's me, yeah.
Like the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and so many other sitcoms. At the last episode, they finish the show. Switch off the light.
Yeah, that's me.
I think it was like that in Friends as well, wasn't it?
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah. I have to be the last person to leave. And then I go back around through all the rooms one last time. You know, officially to make sure I haven't left anything behind, but just to have a little kind of reminisce. And then I switch off the light and lock the door. And then drive away. So, which is, and then you get to the other end and you have to do all the unpacking. But you like the unpacking side of it.
Yeah, I don't know. I like coming into a fresh place and thinking about how I could decorate it. Yeah.
And ooh, I like it. Put your stamp on it. Make it your own place.
Yeah.
And it's like, how can I use this room? And how can I use this room? And where shall I put the recording stuff? And which is, these days, of course, when you say, where shall I put the recording stuff? For most people, it's like, well, it's my laptop. So...
It isn't for me. No, I got a lot of stuff. I collect. Yeah, you know, I have a day job now.
you can
afford things. Yeah.
So, I mean, that actually does bring me back to this album. Is it software synths or is it actually hardware synths you've used on it?
It's no synths at all.
Oh, wow.
It's mostly piano that's processed, like, digitally. So, yeah.
So on the,
I'm not using synths.
On the modular, on all these new records, on the...
Yeah.
All of them...
No synth at all.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm actually stunned, because I just had a mental image of either sort of a screen full of software modulators or, you know, an actual synth with knobs and stuff, and it's... Wow. I'm very impressed.
Well, yeah, if it sounds like soft synths, then I'm not impressed.
Well, it doesn't. Well, the thing is, though, that soft synths now sound as good as hardware synths, so there's no way to really tell the difference as far as I'm concerned. It's like people who say they can tell the difference between an AIFF file and a 192 kilobits per second MP3. I think people who say they can tell the difference, I don't think they're actually telling the truth.
Well, you know, I just spent like 300 euros on a couple of cables for my mixing board, so
See, I think most people, I think once you get past a certain level, most people can't tell the difference. I think if you're trained to listen to the difference, you know, and you do it all day long, then you will notice.
I'm not. I just have this, you know, a friend of mine who is really into this kind of stuff, and he always tells me what I have to buy, and and so I do it because he knows it, and he's old, and he's wise.
Is he like your Gandalf?
Yeah, or from Karate Kid. What's his name?
Mr. Miyagi.
Yes, exactly. That's who he is, and yeah, and he tells me to buy like all these expensive cables, and I do it. And, yeah.
So you go along, and he says, "You need to spend." Yeah, 200
he says,
euros.
Oh, this one brand of cables, it sounds like 70s records, and the other one brand sounds like, it sounds very clean and 90s, and yeah.
And then he goes,
I believe him.
And he goes, and this one that's almost exactly the same for a tenth of the price sounds like shit. Mm. Do not buy it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I'm kind of far more along the lines of, it's £2, I'll buy that. So I have all these little things that are kind of cheap. But then, you know, I think the way your stuff sounds is really good. It does sound great, and it's, you know,
thanks.
I'm very. So was this actual kind of? So did you sit and record yourself playing the piano?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, fantastic. You see, maybe I need to use my father has a baby grand, so maybe I should use that on something.
And, do it.
You know, I should.
You know, pianos are shit cheap. I mean, if you wait, you can find a good deal.
Well, it's even cheaper. I can just drive over to my parents' house and use theirs.
Oh, okay.
So that would work as well. So the whole thing. So, I mean, obviously the two ones that kind of quite processed could almost sound like synths if people weren't any the wiser, which I wasn't. And then you've got the... you've got the other record, which has disappeared off my screen. Where is it? Oh, bloody hell. I've got all these different windows open. Where's it gone? Oh, that doesn't work. That just makes me see everything. Okay, maybe it's on this one. Okay. Yeah, the Rubka record is more... Yep. It sounds more obviously piano.
But yeah, that's the only one that is no real piano in.
And there's the irony of it.
That's the irony, yeah.
So the record that sounds like piano isn't, and the records that sound like synthesizers aren't. And I think that's great. I like that. I think there's something right about that, that the piano record isn't piano. But then it sounds like piano, and that doesn't. So it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
If it sounds like it, and it.
That's where I. Yeah, yeah. But that's where I felt like a fraud. You know, when you said earlier that you're afraid of someone coming at you and saying that you I don't know, you're a fraud. I didn't really play, I didn't play all of these things on this record. I only played some of them, and the rest is programmed.
But the thing is, you're still the decision-making process behind it. You're still the one deciding.
Yeah, I composed it, yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And how's that any different from somebody sitting down, writing out notation, and handing it to somebody else to play?
Yeah, I don't know.
There you go. All you've
Maybe
done.
There's no difference.
There you go. All you've done is you've worked out how the music should sound.
Yeah.
You've given it to your computer to play. And you have decided what sounds the computer should make. So, you know, that's just as real, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, yeah. Well, that's true.
You know? I mean, these days, I am making things with... I've got really into using the little kind of drum racks in Ableton Live. Mm-hmm. And I use that for putting most of my tracks together now. So I grab a load of samples... or little bits of music that I've recorded, and then I drop the MP3s into the drum rack in Live, and then I make little kind of rhythms from these little kind of fragments of melody and tones and stuff, and I very rarely use drums in the drum rack, and put things together that way, make these kind of little knotted sounding short tracks, and you know, I'm not playing any, I couldn't play any of it. And I don't even plan out where the notes are going. I just guess what should sound right.
Yeah, but it's different with piano music, you know. It's
like, yeah,
people assume that you played it.
But there was that famous woman a few years ago that it was turned out after she died that all of her records were fakes. So she'd basically just her and her husband had just they'd taken old recordings and re-released them with her name on them.
That's great.
There was a TV show about it a few years ago. I need to find out what her name was. It was quite funny. What was she called? Let me find it. So probably listeners are already going, I know what it was called. But as this isn't live, that doesn't help. Let me see. She recorded a whole load of things. So it was piano... I do this every episode. There's always something I then look up. Piano releases faked. Let's see if that will bring up the right thing. Joyce Hatto, second hit. Joyce Hatto, yeah, she died in 2006, and she wasn't a particularly good pianist.
Mm-hmm.
And she was married to a guy called William Barrington Coupe. He was convicted of fraud in 1966. Okay, here we go. Hatto became famous very late in life when unauthorised copies of commercial recordings made by other pianists were released under her name, earning her high praise from critics.
Yeah, that's how I feel, you know.
Yeah, but that's not what you're doing, though, is it?
I shouldn't say that, anyway.
No. Unless your album is actually... a record by somebody else altogether.
No, it isn't.
No, you see, so that's, you know, that's very different, because I mean, what she did was she literally took recordings of other people's work and they re-released it with her name and face on the covers. And I think they only worked it out when in May 2005 somebody pointed it out on a Yahoo group that a recording of a Chopin Godowsky piece had exactly the same chord error in it that hers did. So it came out basically because she'd just stolen the music. And but it's not like that, you see, because that's proper fraud. Whereas getting a computer to play something isn't fraud, I think. I think that's
no, it isn't. And I, Originally, I had it written on the album artwork that it's only programmed, and then the guy from the label said I shouldn't do that, so I didn't. But yeah.
But yeah, I think, you know, I think only programmed is a, yeah, I think.
No, yeah, actually, I played some of that.
Yeah, you and know, also, played, yeah. You should just say it's programmed. So what?
Yeah, so what?
You know, dance music's programmed. You don't sit down. You know, people making dance music don't sit down and
play every beat. I know.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's
piano music, so people think it's a guy with a piano, you know?
Yeah. So. But then, I mean, you then think of, I mean, I think maybe the expectation isn't there as much as it used to be. And maybe in piano music it shouldn't be. And it isn't cheating. And anybody who's listening who thinks it is cheating, you're wrong. I mean, the only people I can think of that make music that's, well, electronic music that they actually play every note is the Apparat Organ Quartet, or Quintet, or whatever. Is that quartet or quintet? I can never remember.
I think it's quartet.
Yeah. And they play everything. And they don't sequence anything at all. And it sounds great, but you kind of think that's slightly insane. Why would you put yourself through that? It's kind of just, it's like Rick Wakeman showing off in Yes with his big keyboards.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
You know, but, you know, it's easier if the technology is there that you can get your idea out of your head and into other people's ears in a way that sounds like you want it to sound without you having to sit down and spend 20 years learning to play the piano to a point where you could play it. Then what's wrong with doing it? I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I use software
therapists.
There you go. I use software to do things that I can't do otherwise all the time. So and I see nothing wrong with it. So the new one's out on vinyl. When is the piano record coming out?
In May, I think. It's going to the pressing plant in March.
Is that going to be on vinyl as well?
Originally, it was going to be released on vinyl, but now, you know, the label is Japanese, and they said they had troubles with the European and American distributors don't take vinyl anymore, so it's only going to be on CD, which really sucks. I hate CDs. But whatever.
But I guess it's on a physical format at least, isn't it?
So yeah.
That's quite good. So that's going to be out in May. And then you've got this other one that you gave me a preview of, the All I Want to Be is a Happy Man.
Yeah.
So what's the story with that album? When's that coming out? Because that doesn't seem to be attached to anything at the moment, as far as I can see.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Yeah, I just finished it like, I don't know, 2 weeks ago or something. And I'm just shopping for labels right now. I'm pitching it to various labels, and I'm going to see who takes it.
Would you say that one is kind of the spiritual follow-up to the Modular Anxiety record?
I guess, yeah. I guess you can say that, yeah.
Audibly, it's similar, isn't it? There's a lot of kind of...
no synths.
No synths at all.
Yeah.
It sounds like a synth record with no synths.
It's just piano, really. Real piano.
Piano. So yeah. I still like that the real piano records sound like synths and the not piano record sounds like piano. But I'm really hoping that gets released as well, because I think this is really positive. I think this is a whole different kind of area of... record labels and stuff than maybe you've dealt with before. There's this whole kind of large underground scene that really likes this kind of instrumental stuff.
Yeah.
And it seems to actually do quite well globally. So
yeah, it's weird. You know. When I made pop music, or like, you know, more pop music with Liger, most of the labels did not care, and we did not really sell that many records. And now I'm making this weird music, and all of a sudden, like, you know, labels care, and people care, and Pitchfork cares, and I don't know, it's really weird.
Yeah, because I was going to actually ask you about the Pitchfork thing, because you obviously picked as one of their tracks that they have, did you find that had a positive effect on people then listening to your music?
You know, like, my friends on Facebook, they never cared about my experimental music and about my new music. Now that I'm a Pitchfork approved artist, they suddenly seem to care. So that's, I don't know, I don't know if it's good or bad, but it's something, you know, it has an effect. And yeah,
it legitimizes you to a certain
exactly area. Now they think they can like it or whatever. I don't know.
It's allowed because you're famous now, because you've been on Pitchfork.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's yeah, it's
like, pretty weird.
Yeah, it is odd. It's very strange.
Yeah.
But I can imagine that these days that then translates into people actually going and listening to the rest of your music on maybe your Bandcamp page or something.
Yeah.
Did you notice a big spike in downloads or listeners after that?
I never cared about like the Bandcamp statistics. I never looked it up. Maybe I should, but I did not have a Facebook page when the Pitchfork thing happened. And right after it happened, I had a lot of, you know, random friend requests on my personal Facebook page. And so I decided to make the, you know, the fan page.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it can be a bit of a risk, can't it? Starting to let everybody in on your personal Facebook page.
Yeah.
Then you start going, who is this? I don't know who this person is.
Yeah.
I have that. I mean, I used to get that from doing the atheism podcast I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get sudden splurges of people adding me on Facebook, and it, you know, I'd add them if I knew somebody who knew them, and if they didn't, then. But I found now that Google Plus is actually far better for that kind of thing, because, you know, people are slowly drifting towards Google Plus, I'm finding. But
it's, really, I just drifted towards it because I made a new YouTube account and they forced me to create a Google Plus account.
Yeah, I think it's starting to get used a lot more, and I think it is partly because, as you say, they've kind of forced people to do it. You know,
it's
like that cartoon of the little Google Plus little child looking up at Big Google and going, "Nobody loves me," and the Big Google going, "I will make them love you."
Yeah,
and it's a bit like that, but it's quite good because you can just bung these randoms into circles that have got specific names, and you don't have to share stuff with them, so you don't have to say, "No, fuck off, I don't know who you are."
Oh.
You could just go, "Okay, put them into people who've added me circle," and then you can just ignore them. Or if they want, and then, or you, if you want to, you know, share stuff with them, you just pick that circle as the circle you're sharing it with. So that's quite good. So, you know, it's better than, you know, I think the problem with Facebook is it's kind of all or nothing, unless you've got a group page set up. And having a group page is a good idea, because then you can keep yourself at an arm's length from the stalkers and the weirdos.
I wish you could go back to MySpace.
Well, you could, but MySpace these days.
Yeah, well, exactly. We could. Yeah.
Do you mean good MySpace when it wasn't shit?
Yeah. Like 10 years ago.
Yeah, when you could change the HTML and everything.
Yeah, I remember that you had like over 1,000 like fans on your The Moths page, and I thought you were you were really famous.
Really?
And I asked you, how did this happen? And you had no idea. I don't know. I think at this point you also thought you were like kind of internet famous. I don't know.
I think it had reached the point where I think I was known. I was globally known to about 10 people.
1,000. Jesus. I could. Yeah. Nowadays, if you have 1,000 Facebook fans, that's great. That's.
Well, I suppose, yeah. Because, I mean, my music pages now, I don't think any of them are in triple figures now. So, you know.
Yeah, you see?
Yeah, it's a tragedy of... it's one of the things of getting old.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm 41 now, and it's quite depressing.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of weird that I'm actually starting to become slightly better known for talking to other people. Than for what I do. I mean, it's like...
Don't think about it. No.
I'm going to try not to, because, I mean, this podcast kind of sits between kind of 500 and 2,000 listeners per episode. It kind of goes up and down, but it's slowly going up and then has little dips and then goes up again. So I'm hoping that it'll continue to go up.
Oh, yeah, this one's going to be a dip, I guess.
No, this one's going to be a hit. This one's going to be...
Yeah, you should think so. Okay.
Yeah, this Pitchfork. Is going to be fresh on the heels of a well-known artist the week before. Not saying that you're not well-known, but, you know, one of these people who could get on magazines and stuff, who's at last week's show with Matt Elliott, you know. There's going to be some hangers-on from last week's show that are still going to listen to this week's show.
Hopefully.
So that's the way to think about it. That's the positive way to look at it. So yeah, hopefully it'll continue that way. So yeah, but yeah, I kind of do sometimes think I should be famous for my music, but then I think that I'm not very good. And then,
yeah.
But that, like we say, that's what we always think, isn't it? We all think
exactly.
We're not any good
at it. Yeah.
And I think most people who do this kind of thing have that doubt that they're any good, and they just are waiting to be caught out at some point, and for somebody to go, you're rubbish. And we're probably not rubbish. We're actually probably okay. There's just a lot of people now.
Yes, we are, definitely.
Yeah. There's a lot of crap people out there, and we're not them.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe we should. It's almost an hour now, but that's a new topic we could get into. all the crap that's out there and how it, you know.
It's because it's easy to do it. It's because there's that.
Yeah. It's easy to make music and it's easy to distribute music.
Yes, it doesn't cost anything.
I don't think it's a good thing. Everyone thinks it's a good thing, but I don't think so.
I think it's got a mix of the two. I think it can be good and bad.
I don't know.
Yeah,
I think it's bad. Excuse me.
Well, this is something that 16 Deluxe said. They felt that there should be more gatekeepers again. To stop the dross getting through.
I think there should be more, you know, like 15 years ago, there was at least some financial efforts you had to overcome when making music. And nowadays you don't even have to have, I don't know, you can just release everything. It's weird. You don't have to even mean it. You don't have to even want to do it. You can just,
You technically don't even need to have a computer to do it. You can do it on your phone.
Yeah.
You know, you can record it on your phone. You can master it on your phone.
And that just waters down everything else, you know, and it's just,
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's a certain amount of kind of chances just doing it because it's the cool thing to do.
Yeah.
You know, like they're at college.
There's so much noise.
Yeah, there's the college guy going, yeah, well, I've made a chill wave record. It's out on this label that I've made up, and it's, you know, I've sold it to four of my friends, so I'm, you know, a big noise on campus. And I think, yeah, there is an element of that, definitely, which isn't a particularly healthy thing. But my wife has come in looking for something. The measuring tape?
Yes.
It's on the table downstairs in the dining room.
I'm trying to make you not speak.
No, it's okay, I can speak. Kat came in and she was like doing this kind of...
Pulling gesture.
Yeah, pulling gesture for me to try and guess what she was pulling. You know, like if you put your fingers together and then you pull them apart and you look like you're pulling an elastic band or something like that.
Please cut this part out.
I'm not cutting this part out. Nothing gets cut. Nothing.
Hi, Kat.
Dino says hello.
Hello, Dino.
I don't know if you heard that. She said hello, Dino, very quickly.
Yeah, I heard it.
Yeah, it's on the dining room table downstairs. All the way down there. I'm not going to tell listeners what just happened. but yeah, I agree. I think there's a certain element of people do it, like you say, they do it because they can and not because they have
any
drive
to do it. Yeah, exactly,
And I think that makes it harder for everybody else because, like you said, there is so much noise then.
Yeah.
And it's so hard to find good stuff. I mean, I am sure that there's out there right now music that I could hear and would think, this is the music I've been searching for all my life. This is fantastic. This person has made loads of stuff. It's fantastic. I want to hear more of this. But I might never hear it.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it'll be some guy sitting in his room in, you know, Shanghai somewhere, or someone in some place in New Zealand, or, you know, in some obscure little place in the States or Canada or South America. And it's guaranteed.
Austria.
Yeah, it's guaranteed that, Austria. But the thing is, people know where to find yours. But yeah, that music is sitting there somewhere.
Yeah.
Because I think part of what, with me making music, has been always trying to make the music that I want to hear from other people.
Oh.
And people not making it, so I've had to make it. And I think maybe that's something that's a fairly common thing with musicians as well. We have that drive, but maybe not with these new guys.
Yeah, nowadays it's like musicians make music that they already know, and they don't make the music that they want to hear. They make the music that is proven to be successful, and I don't know, it's cool.
Yeah,
everything's about being cool. Maybe I'm getting old.
No, I'm getting mental images now of kind of quite wealthy US college kids, you know, buying themselves a little kind of cheap Casio, a loop station,
a microcork,
a loop station, and a little projector to project kind of swirly patterns, and putting on a poncho, and then calling themselves something like, you know, Angel Claws. Or something.
Ooh, ooh.
And then
I might steal that.
Yeah, you can, yeah. Or I don't know, Diamond Space Skull or something like that. And playing shows to their friends at the local coffee shop and going, yeah, I do it because I'm just channeling the vibe. But it's the easiest thing on earth, just switch on a looper and start playing rubbish through it.
Yeah. And they have like 3,000 Facebook fans.
Yeah. That's kind of sickening, isn't it?
Because they look cool.
Yeah.
I don't know. This is like we're talking like old people. you know.
Well, how old
bitter,
are you now?
Bitter grown-ups.
Just out of interest, how old are you now?
I'm 32 years old.
You see, you're quite young still. You're 9 years younger than I am.
Yeah, I'm as old as you were when we met on MySpace.
Yeah, totally. You know, so but you've reached that point where you're now into your 30s and you're starting to kind of have that. Things are starting to hurt that didn't. And
yeah, you know, exactly.
To cheer you up, it gets worse.
Oh, thanks.
The physical,
I know.
Yeah, the physical deterioration doesn't reverse. It's shit. No, but I'm now. You know, I'm sitting. I don't look cool. You know, I've got a beard that's got grey in it.
Man, I wish I had your beard. I think your beard's cool.
You could have my beard. You just don't have to shave.
No, I can't grow a beard.
Oh no.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Oh man, now I feel like I'm rubbing it in your face with my beard. Because I used to have big sideburns, and I used to have those. And I used to explain to people that I had those.
Yeah, I have sideburns. That's what I. That's all I can grow. Sideburns.
Do you remember, my mine were huge. I had huge, great, big kind of mutton chop sideburns. And I used to say to people, the reason I have them was because it's my way of saying, yes, I could grow a beard, and it would look like this, but I just choose not to. And then I got lazy and just grew a beard. So I've got a beard and...
Oh, it looks great.
And long hair.
I got the picture of you in front of me with the Angry Birds hat.
Yeah.
And the beard.
And you can't see the great big long hair. I should publish the Angry Birds hat picture at some point for people to see. Because it has been mentioned before. I think it was Throwing Muses mentioned it. That I looked like an angry bird.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah. I don't know where my Angry Birds hat is. It's somewhere in the house, but things disappear. So I think, if you're out there and you're listening to music and you're making music just because you think it's the cool thing to do because you've got a loop station with some of your college fund from daddy, break it now and stop ruining it for everyone else.
Die.
I mean, maybe artistically, not literally. Yeah. You know, I don't want to cause a spate of campus suicides. So we should probably draw things to a close. Where would people go to find your work online?
Maybe Google. I don't know. Well, I have an official website, but you know, maybe you should put a link on your podcast.
That will happen with
whatever. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, that happens.
It's not an easy name to remember It's.
But it's. Any listeners who are good at spelling things just off the top of their heads, if you want to just type it into your phone right now, listeners, if you're listening and don't want to look at the link that will be below it, you could go to dinospilatini.com. And there's also, for the more kind of visual side of things, visual.dinospilatini.com.
Yeah, you did your research.
I do. This is unusual for me because usually with people, actually, this is the weird thing. With people I know, I tend to then do a bit of research. With people I don't know at all, I tend to just wing it. And then I panic because I don't know anything about the person before I start, you know, beyond a couple of records that I own. So, but the links will be, as always, they will be in the information below the podcast and findable online and Googleable and all this kind of malarkey. So it's good. So before we draw things to a close, is there anything that you'd like to add that we haven't said?
No, I don't think so. No.
In that case, go on.
I was just... gonna say this was kind of pleasant, you know. I was really nervous, but yeah, it turned out to be okay. You're a great host.
Thank you. I try to, like you said, I try to make it more kind of like a chat with somebody.
Yeah,
you know, it's yeah. I think it's more.
It works.
I think it's better. Yeah, think it's a better thing to do. So I think I'm doing the right thing, and it's
definitely.
I would hate it if somebody came on and felt stressed. Mm. That would be awful.
I couldn't imagine that. No.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll draw things to a close. All that's left to say then is a future library goodbye. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for downloading this episode of Future Library. Future Library is brought to you by PetPiranha.com and is hosted by myself, Alex Bottom. The podcast is free, but if you do want to show your appreciation, feel free to go along to alexbottom.co.uk and click through to music, where you'll be able to find things that you can buy, or go to asmallglassghost.co.uk where you can buy my latest music. Episodes come out when I feel like it, mostly weekly. But that's it, so thank you for listening. Thank you.